Life Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, your host for the show and also founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that advocates for the adoption of an integrative model of care, one that addresses the many needs of those with cancer as a whole person, rather than simply as a physical disease. To me, it's been crystal clear all along that physical treatment alone simply isn't good enough for an illness that threatens and affects every aspect of our lives. And many, many people who we have supported over the last 20 years would harshly agree with me. But it's been disturbing to note just how few men we've been able to help. 20 years ago, you could almost say that the level of interest from men was zero. And compared with that, things are definitely better now than they were. But there are still woefully few men accessing the benefits that integrative medicine can offer. And as a man myself, I can say with certainty that that's not because their needs are any less or even fundamentally different to women's. We're all just people, after all. But tragically, it's to do with the societal conditioning of men. In an effort to address the situation, Yes to Life's created an awareness campaign called For Men. Unsurprisingly, it features four men, four extraordinary survivors of late-stage cancer, but the campaign is also for men. And these men have all agreed to join forces with each other and with the charity to act as a touchpoint for men with cancer everywhere and to let them know what benefits lie beyond the boundaries of our male conditioning. Today's show is a first chance to introduce our four men all at once, something I've been looking forward to immensely. A big welcome to you all to the Yes to Life show.
Hi there, Robin.
Hello, fellas.
Hi, Robin.
Hi, Robin.
Nice to see you all again.
Yes. So, look, let's have some introductions. I'm just going to run it around the screen as I see you. And maybe you could just start off by telling us a little bit about yourself, just who you are, how old you are, a tiny bit about your story, what happened to you. Just give people a picture of who you are. So, John, you're at the top, so I'm going to weigh straight in with you.
Okay. Hi, I'm John Bennett, and I'm 70 years young. And 8 years ago, I was diagnosed with advanced prostate cancer. My PSA was 116 when they discovered it, and went up to 124 in the first week. That put me into a state of disarray, disbelief, and I did not ever want to do anything other than holistic, but I was told I had 6 months, maybe a year to live. And so after doing quite a bit of research on holistic with cancer, the things that kept on coming up was 2 years, 2 years to actually get back into shape. So I decided to do some of the medical treatments, and I did radiotherapy for 8 weeks, which was a real ball buster. Can I say ball buster?
You've said it.
You've seen the count for me.
Exactly.
And it crashed my immune system, and lying dormant on the back of my right leg was a melanoma. They incised that, but within weeks it had spread to two tumours on my right groin, two on my left lung, 12 tumours in my liver. I had immunotherapy. That didn't work. They gave me double immunotherapy, sent my autoimmune system into chaos, and started taking down my liver. So 2 weeks before Christmas 2019, I was in a hospital bed on a major dose of steroids to try to calm down the autoimmune. And the oncologist number two said, we can't do anything more for you. If we give you any more immunotherapy, it'll kill you. And so we have to stop. There's nothing else we can do for you. At that point, I told him I will be cancer-free by April 2020. in 4 months. And he said, well, that's just not going to happen. 3.5 months later, I did all my scans and the two tumors on my right groin were completely gone. The two in my left lung were completely gone. And his description of the 12 tumors in my liver were, he said, they looked like they've exploded and all that's left is embers. And there was no activity in them whatsoever. So all along for 2 years, I had been on a path, a holistic path as well, alongside my my treatments.
And that's great. That's a great start. So, yeah, we've got plenty more to talk about, but that's a good picture of quite an extraordinary story. Okay, let's move on. Murray, would you like to introduce yourself? You've been on the Yes Life show before, but you've probably got some new listeners this time. Why don't you do the same job? Just tell us a little bit about yourself and what happened, basically.
Hi there. My name's Murray Cluley. I am 57. I have to think about that. 57 years young as well. I am an aircraft engineer to trade, was living a fantastic life in the Middle East, very privileged, enjoying life basically to the full, where in 2012 I passed blood in my urine and went to the hospital, had a scan, and the doctor came into the waiting room basically looking rather solemn and glum, basically to inform me that I had kidney cancer. That was a large tumor on my left-hand kidney. They diagnosed renal cell carcinoma, and they also said that there were signs of that it had gone secondary into my lungs, signs of nodules there. So they said the priority was to basically get the kidney removed. So I went to London to get the kidney removed, had a radical nephrectomy, and then basically was told that it looked like it was terminal and the only answer was this palliative chemotherapy. And if I took the palliative chemotherapy, they sort of mentioned that I would probably have about 5 years to live. I was quite fortunate to be able to have two oncologists. So I had obviously the kidney specialist and oncologist in the Royal Marsden in London. So I told him, right, I'm going to consider my options, and I'm going to go back to Dubai to speak to my other oncologist to get his opinion. And that gave me the breathing space that I needed to realize that I really didn't want to go down the palliative chemotherapy route. I didn't want to spend the last few months or years of my life feeling like crap. And I was very lucky to meet a colleague of mine who cured himself with stomach cancer, a Malaysian guy. He showed me all the before and after scans, and he said he did it basically by changing his lifestyle, eating a very clean plant-based diet for 3 months. He reckoned he managed to cure it within 3 months. So that planted the seed of hope, and I'm here to tell the story today.
You are indeed looking very healthy. Yeah. Thank you. That's great. Yeah. Tim.
Okay. Hello, everybody. Tim Messon, aged 52. And again, somebody had to actually think about that. Was diagnosed with advanced stage bowel cancer at the age of 49, which I believe was 10 years ahead of the most sort of average schedule that you'd get that particular cancer. So I felt quite cheated at the time. I was guilty, as most of us are, of having ignored certain symptoms, I guess. I don't want to speak on behalf of everybody, but I think it's fairly common with men to do that. And I was typical of this. There was a missed opportunity a couple of years before where they could have caught it and they didn't. And I just left a certain sort of meeting with a doctor feeling that I had nothing to worry about. And then a couple of years later, I was actually diagnosed with bowel cancer. And obviously it comes as a horrendous surprise. You're all going to know the feeling if you've been through it. But I think my story really starts as one of sort of a bizarre reason to believe in the power of the mind. And if it's okay, I'll probably tell that rather than go into the details of what I did afterwards, because it sort of makes sense of my journey and where I'm coming from. Now, it takes a little bit to suspend your belief in this one, but 2 years before I was diagnosed with cancer, I was sitting down by the side of the River Trent in Nottingham, and I was just in a state of relaxation, and three mallard ducks have flown over. And you know, I've told this story many times for obvious reasons since, but I watched them land, and just as I'm watching these birds, I just fell in love with the power of nature, as we often do over and over again. And I thought how amazing it was that they'd learned to fly in a V formation and cut down on dragon just in a moment of sort of whimsical thinking. I thought, you know what? I want these birds to come and sit over. I want them to come walk over to me and sit down with me. What would you do up in that moment to somehow get this to happen? And the inner hippie took over, and I decided that I would try and send them warmth from my heart. And I know this sounds crazy, and it still does to me as well, but that's what I did for about 30 seconds, and then snapped out of it and put my back against a tree and put some music on. I thought, what a weirdo I can be when I'm left unattended for too long. And then I don't know what happened. A minute later, I felt the need to open my eyes, and I looked to my left, and heading towards me in a straight line on purpose with conviction, a 3-mallard ducks, and they came all the way over, and one sat touching my hip whilst I'm sitting my back against a tree. The other one, my elbow, the other one, my shoulder, and all three of them tucked their beaks into their wings, and they all had a little kick. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to join in, because that seemed like the right thing to do. So I think for just a few minutes there, we're just in a beautiful union, having a sleep together. And then they did what ducks do. They shook their wings and they went. And at the time, I didn't really know what that meant. It was incredible, because I'd just seen something that opens up a massive area of unknown, but I didn't know until later on how powerful that would be. And then 2 years later, I got cancer, and it all felt like there was a reason for this happening. And I just went through cancer talking relentlessly about these 3-mallard ducks. It's like every fourth message in my WhatsApp to my partner was just, don't worry, Kerry, I'm going to be okay, 3-mallard ducks. Now, I'm not crazy enough to think that they are directly responsible, but having permission to operate in this massive field that we think of as the unknown and not know the power of the placebo effect is just the main feature of everything I did. Everything that I went through to right to the end, and that was when, to cut a long story short, I had ignored surgeons, which I'm not recommending people do, but I felt so sure I was going to be okay that I did for quite a few months. And eventually, you know, I caved in because my partner said that she didn't want to risk me dying. I promise that if after yet more scans, and we're talking 9 months after radiotherapy and chemo, after another set of scans, if there was still a tumor, I'd have an operation. So I did succumb, but it never felt right. Not right until the last moment. On the day that I was penciled in for my operation, this operation was to lose an almighty 5 organs. I was terrified. Instead of a phone call telling me that I needed to get into hospital, on the 17th of September 2024, I got a phone call from my surgeon. He started the call like it was going to be the worst news I'd ever heard, but he actually presented me with the best words you're ever going to hear, and that is that the tumor that I'd been doing everything I could to get rid of had just disappeared. And I asked him how many times this has happened before. And I'm proud to say that at this point of the process with this particular surgeon, I was only the second after 360 cases that at this late stage, the tumor just upped and went. It didn't feel like that much of a surprise to me, because I trained my brain to believe it was going to happen. But obviously to everyone around me, it was an almighty moment. I'm sorry if that went on a little bit, but I just want to explain why I believe so much in the power of the mind, or how important the power of the mind might be, just to keep you looking up and not down.
Mm-hmm. Amazing story. Thanks so much.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hey, and last but far from least, Dale.
Well, my name's Dale Atkinson, and firstly, I'm going to make everyone else in the call feel old, because yeah. I am a grand old 37 years old.
I hate this about you, Dale.
So I'm 37. I was diagnosed at 35 back in 2024, and I think probably giving a little bit of backstory is important for me. So I spent 20 years working in finance, essentially as an investigator and a researcher. My job was to look at, you know, regulations, to look at laws, to look at money launderers, fraudsters, all these sorts of fun things. Then roll on 2024. And before I got my diagnosis, my partner actually had a funny turn in the summer of 2024. They thought she'd had a heart attack, carted her into hospital, and just by chance, somebody did an X-ray and they found a carcinoma in her lung. So on the 3rd of October 2024, she went in and had a full lobectomy, so the entire upper right lobe of her lung removed. Major surgery, she came home on the 5th of October. 10 days later, on our youngest little boy's first birthday, I then went in to have an endoscopy. Being that my partner had only just had major surgery herself, I had to drive myself there and back, so I didn't have the anesthetic. I just had a numbing spray, and I got to see it there on the screen. I'd spent somewhere around 6 or 7 years going to the doctor pretty persistently. I'd been having swallowing issues, gastric issues. I was having these shooting pains all up through my shoulder. And it turned out that although a doctor kept passing it off as stress and lifestyle and all these sorts of things, it was a nearly 10-centimeter esophageal adenocarcinoma. It was pressing against a cluster of nerves in the middle of my chest, the same one that you get, you know, the same one that twigs when you have a heart attack. And I was essentially suffering through the pain of a heart attack 24/7 for over a year before anybody was willing to do anything about it. Went on from there to find out, well, I should probably also point out my mother then died the week afterwards. Found out on the day of my eldest little boy's third birthday. And then 2 days later, I went in to meet my oncologist and I was told inoperable, incurable, you know, do not pass go, absolutely nothing we can do. And the letter they sent me home with said that even with systemic treatment, that they believed I only had 11 and a half months to live. So being a researcher and investigator, I turned all of the pain, all of the grief, all of the anger, all of the upset into fuel. And I went off and researched. I did what I do best. I went off and I dug through research papers. I went through somewhere around 4,000 or 5,000, maybe 6,000 research papers in a matter of months. I read everything from, you know, Jane McClellan's seminal book, How to Starve Your Cancer, through to Kelly Turner's Radical Remission. I read all of these sorts of things. I came across some amazing practitioners, some amazing clinicians, reached out and spoke to hundreds of people across the world, from the Thomas Seyfrieds through to Dr. Carl Felt, through to the amazing Amanda King, et cetera, et cetera. And I started to piece together a plan. And in the January 2025, so 3.5 months after I was diagnosed, I started a protocol that I had designed alongside a brilliant integrative oncologist called Dr. Harry Kuan, a naturopath called Amanda King. And I also used feeders from things like next generation sequencing and had researchers from the University of Westminster. A lady called Dr. Isabella Cooper was helping me and assisting me as well. And I started a protocol with their help in January 2025. By March 2025, the majority of my metastases, which was, you know, 10 to 12 lymph nodes, secondaries, all these fun things, had vanished. And by the end of the summer 2025, my cancer had vanished. I had some distal thickening of the esophageal wall remaining. And I attribute it to a mixture of science, evidence. Nothing I did was woo-woo. It was all based on the actual science. I did the next generation sequencing to pick out the individual pathways of my cancer, and I attacked them with every piece of science I could get my hands on. I made sure to run it through proper clinicians. I made sure to monitor everything I was doing, track everything I was doing, used a mixture of AI and other tools in order to keep a really close handle on everything. We measured my blood up to every 2 weeks at various points. You know, at worst, it was monthly, and we just continued and continued and continued. And as I sit here now, I'm no visible disease awaiting, no evidence of disease, hopefully, in the next couple of months when I get a PET scan.
Wow. Great. Well, look, thanks, guys, for introducing yourself. So you have been brought together by this campaign. You've actually met up at the Integrative and Personalized Medicine Congress recently, which is great. And you're getting to know each other. And from where I stand, it's amazing to see four very different characters, four very different stories you've got behind you, four very different cancers, four very different responses to your diagnosis. I mean, everything from ducks to high tech. But at the end of the day, you're all here. And according to the powers that be, you shouldn't be. So that's an extraordinary thing. And it begs questions about the commonalities in amongst all these differences there are between you, which is so interesting. And it's something that I want to explore much more in the coming months.
Can I just point out something I've just noticed, Robin, and talking to the other three lads over the last
few
weeks, we all have really loving, caring partners, and I it's only just dawned on me speaking to them that's something that we all have in common. Obviously, there's more to getting well than just that, but I think we'd all appreciate just how much the women in our lives have sort of helped, and our families that we've got as well. But it's occurred today talking to John that he's exactly the same. Mm. And obviously, Murray and Dale. Yeah.
Great. Thanks for putting that in there. Yeah, I think, you know, you've put your finger on a very important ingredient in the whole mix here. Yeah, it's very interesting. What are the commonalities? Because, I mean, a bit like Kelly Turner with her research started looking for the commonalities between all the people she spoke to who had radical remissions. These are they really tell you something. The things that are common, well, they must be important, you know, or they're likely to be important anyway. So, look, I'd just love to hear any more of your responses to hearing each other's stories. Does anybody want to chime in with a response there?
Well, touching on this, on that similar theme, I think the overriding message to me is that, and we came up with a name. I think you decided to call it Four Men initially as a sort of draft name, but
yes,
I think that name's very apt because we're just normal four men. There's nothing special about us. There's nothing special about me anyway. And it's all about getting messages to other normal men out there, you know, that our stories basically to help them and to help people.
Right.
What one thing that seems to be an overriding factor, and you can call it how you like this, sheer bloody mindedness would be one of the ways to describe it. But I think it's talking to the other three men that, you know, that you've got me involved in, and you know, they're incredible men and perfectly inspirational for me right now. But also the desire to get well, you know, however that comes. In my case, it helped that I had this moment where, you know, there's a huge gap in human understanding that opened things up to me, but that still comes down to a scientific use of the power of placebo. But every single one of us has found our way to a point where we appear to be really determined and have a belief that we would have got well however we went about it. It seems to be a common thread.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts?
For me, there's also agency and self-advocacy.
Right. Yeah.
I think the fact that we were all willing to put our head above the parapet, we were all willing to stand up for ourselves,
yeah,
we were all willing to take agency in our journey and decide for ourselves.
Yeah.
We were four men who have decided to make a stand, as it were. We decided how we were to be treated. We ended up becoming the CEO of our own healthcare, as I keep using in various different forums at the moment. And we took control of things. And I think that control gives you an element of ability in your own healthcare. It gives you an element of responsibility. And with that responsibility, it gives you more chance of survival.
Yeah. The for me, it was mastering self-discipline and self-control I mean, it was once I'd accepted the initial diagnosis, it was just research, exactly what you're saying, Dale. And it's just so many rabbit holes to go down, so many different of opinions from some of the experts. And I recognize quite a few of the people that you spoke about. But for me, it was really mastering self-discipline. So I stuck to I found the things that I thought that I believed in, that I could believe in, and I did those things. I had 30 things that I found that I could believe in these things. And I brought that down to, well, you can't do 30 things in one day. I got it down to 16 things that I did every day for full on 2 years without fail, every single day. It's like Groundhog Day. I felt like I was Bill Murray and the alarm was going to go off at 6 o'clock and I was going to go out.
I know that feeling only too well.
Yeah. Rise and shines, campers. But it was just the consistency of finding the things that you believe in that will get you well. And those are the things that I did every day.
I think just to build on that, John, I think there's also the idea of learning. I think each of us went and had a thirst for knowledge in this. Each of us went to try and understand what was happening to us and what we could do about it.
Yeah.
And I don't think any of us, having spoken to the three of you and yourself, Robin, as well, I don't think the three of us particularly ever stopped learning. I think each of us is very open-minded.
Yeah.
We are very willing to take on new directions, new ideas, new concepts, and we adapt and we update and we consistently sort of push ourselves forward in order to become better at what we're trying to do for ourselves and for our families.
Yeah, and become better people for doing that too.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Absolutely, John.
I think one of the things that I found it exactly agrees with what you're saying is the moment that you do make these steps to learn about the disease, to try and find ways of tackling your own potential mental health issues during this period of your life or whatever it might be. But as soon as you start this learning process and particularly believing in the medicines that you take, you just take back some control from this illness. And the moment you do that, the moment you sort of employ whatever systems it is to make you feel like you're reversing the sort of power dynamic, you're going on the attack. A light at the end of a long tunnel can appear. And the moment you see that, you just have this, the moment I felt like I could see that, I just felt like I was on the attack. And it made all the difference. And it was just taking those first steps into learning about my illness and talking to other people and seeing how they dealt with it. And it's, pivotal, really.
All right. Yeah, Murray.
And mental health is a really important part. I mean, it took me a long time to get diagnosed with stage 4 terminal cancer. I think your life, my life wasn't in a good place. My head wasn't in a good place at the best of times. So a part of me thought that was it. I was a dead man walking, you know. But I think deep down, I knew that it wouldn't get me in the end. But it took me a while to gradually realize that, you know, by sticking to a plant-based diet, I could clear my head a little bit more. But it did take me a while to realize that there's so much out there. And I think doing all of the research to find out of the holistic treatments, whatever there is, it can take. It's like a full-time job to learn to get that information and that. And, you know, you need to try and be objective. And it sounds like Dale was very objective in creating this plan. He could obviously get all that information and keep a clear head to do that. I think initially my head wasn't in a state to do that. And it was almost like I was doing it for my wife and kids only, that I'd ripped myself off. And it did take probably 6 months before the meditation and the plant-based diet started to make a difference and to make an impact that I could do this, that I could actually, I actually formed that belief that I could cure this cancer, you know?
Mm.
What a moment that is, though, when you feel that, though, Murray.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's not one moment. So it takes a while. You know, it's like it's got to do self-affirmations and it gradually sinks in, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a roller coaster, really, isn't it? But I think as long as you know you're heading in what you feel to be the right direction, then it's, you know, it's a roller coaster that's, you can actually manage to ride it. But it's hard work. It's hard work. You have to apply yourself.
Mm.
Yep, definitely.
I did anyway.
The nail on the head, I think, Murray, when you said, you know, I think I was doing it for my wife and kids. Yeah, you've got to have a strong reason to live. If you've got a really strong reason to live, then, you know, that's the first part. That's the first hurdle to get over. Then it's just, okay, well, I'm going to live. So
yep.
We've sorted on. That one. Move now on. Let's yeah. get on with the research. And
exactly.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What we're facing here, what a lot of what this campaign is about, it's for men. It's not just for people, it's for men. And it's that for a reason, which is that our experience at Yes to Life is that the proportion of men who explore integrative cancer care is very low. It's bigger than it was. It was virtually zero 20 years ago. And it's better than that now, but it's still rather is poor. It's very poor. And in my book, it's not because men don't need the benefits of integrative medicine. They do every bit as much as women do. So we're trying to do something about that to raise awareness. So what I'd like to do is just explore a little bit what your views are on the obstacles to men. What's in the way that's stopping them reaching out for this type of help, this sort of knowledge, to explore their options in the ways that you guys have? What do you think are the obstacles?
Ourselves.
Yeah, exactly.
It all comes down to the individual. I think, unfortunately, men are taught from a very early age to keep things in, to become an island. And there was always that old saying that every man is his own island.
Yeah.
We are, and we segregate ourselves from people who can enrich that. We close off ideas outside of it, and we self-insulate. And it's partly protection. It's partly how we, because I believe men are highly emotional creatures, it's how we isolate ourselves from being damaged as human beings. But it's also how we protect those around us from seeing that we are breaking down. And when a cancer diagnosis happens, it's such a shock to the system that I think men hibernate inside themselves. They you know, think of it like a bear hibernating. They go and hide in a cave and they shut the door and they just shut themselves away from the world. And that means they're not receptive to things outside of it. It means they're not willing to talk to others. It means they're not willing to open their mind to other ideas. And unless you get a diagnosis like one of ours, you quite often don't feel you have the permission to either. And I think the other side of this, and sorry guys, I'm going to make 2 points. The other side of this is the classic idea that we should listen to a doctor. I think if you look all the way back to things like the Milgram experiment, which came out of the Second World War, we have a propensity to listen to people in white coats. And I think there is a pervasive idea within society at this moment in time that the doctor knows best, that they are somebody who's studied and done a PhD, and therefore they know what they're talking about. And I don't disagree that they do, absolutely. But I would narrow that to the fact that they know the standard of care. They don't know what else exists. They don't know all of the options. They know what they are taught to know. They know chemotherapy, immunotherapy, radiotherapy. They don't know about integrative care. And unless you find somebody who does, then you don't have all the options. You don't need to just listen to the person in the white coat. You don't need to just do as you are told. Sorry, I'm going off on a tangent now and trying to encourage people to be naughty and break free. But
anybody else want to throw in anything on the obstacles?
Well, I think what's really important to note here is that we were probably, before our diagnosis, what you might call typical men. I can obviously only speak for myself, but I feel like it's sort of fairly common that I was the kind of man that saved up two or three ailments before I'd go and see a doctor.
Right.
You know, I'm terrible. I'm standard, a cliche of a middle-aged man who's scared of the doctors. What I don't think we want to sort of, or what we want to try and fight, is the idea that men have to wait for something really bad to happen before they start, you know, using the doctor properly. And I'd say that we are all massively changed in our approach towards, you know, the awkwardness of talking about health because of one pivotal moment in our life, and that's a cancer diagnosis. And I noticed that, you know, when we were sat in the pub when we all met, which was, you know, great to meet the guys and we've got like a house on fire, or like you might say, four men with sheer trauma. But the conversation flowed and it was different. That's because we can talk about these things because we've been through that. And I just don't want other men to wait until they go through something and, you know, then become comfortable talking about these issues.
Mm.
Okay. Yeah.
I've got a prostate cancer men's group, and the common thing that came up about men, why we don't go and see a doctor or find out what's going on with us, it just comes down to one word, and it's fear.
Yeah.
We're frightened to find out because we might have to do something we don't want to do. And with prostate cancer, one of the big things is so many men think that if the doctor thinks you've got prostate cancer or maybe on the way to that, then they're going to get a finger stuck up their backside to tickle their prostate. And I think, well, is that homophobic?
That's just, I think there's just worse things that can happen, isn't there?
Yeah.
And it's all taken into context.
Well, you could go in for surgery and have half your organs removed.
There you go, mate. Exactly that.
Yeah. Well, I was in a men's group in Sydney for 15 years. And the combination of all these different people, I mean, one side of it was this kind of multi-millionaire and the other side of it was a postman, and the broad spectrum of all these men was just amazing to hear them open up and talk about their lives. But bringing that to here to the UK and having a prostate cancer men's group, in the area that I'm living in, my local GP said there's over 600 men in this local area who have prostate cancer. And yet we've only so far been able to get 6 men to join the prostate cancer men's group. Everyone's too afraid to come and talk. They don't want to open up. And it's a real shame because the guys that are being with me in the group, they just learn so much, and we all learn so much from each other, and especially the experiences that each man has had. I mean, one of the guys had an oncologist who he couldn't understand what the oncologist was saying because English was a second language, and he couldn't understand, and he just agreed to do everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I hear him talking now about what he went through, it was just horrendous. He had no agency. He had no agency whatsoever.
Yeah.
That's one of the big things he said. I wish I had had these conversations with you before I did any of the things. I mean,
There's so much benefit from sharing in this way. It's that, you know, only we can get that message across that there's massive benefits to gaining the support of other people in the same situation. So, yeah, extraordinary. Look, the notable thing is, okay, you four didn't get stopped by that. Anything to tell us about why you were able to break out of that box?
Well, to actually get help, you mean, in the first place?
Yeah, yes, to start exploring, to look at your options, not to accept the fact you've been told you're going to have all your organs taken out or you're going to die or whatever it is, that actually saying, well, maybe, let's see.
I think I've been lucky that I've sort of, I've got this ability to receive good advice. I'm probably not as, you know, academic as Dale is or detailed and focused as he was, but I looked hard enough that I felt like I was coming across the right people at the right time. And I just learned to trust my sort of this inner voice that came and started sort of, you don't hear it, but you feel like that you're getting some sort of insight. And I suppose it's the power of information, reading enough, talking to people, and then maybe meeting the right people. And that just seemed to happen quite early for me. So it wasn't such a moment of me deciding. It was just life happening to me in a really sort of kind fashion, which sounds odd because obviously I was scared of an illness, but also sort of the right people came at the right time, I suppose.
Dale, what was your experience?
I was going to let Murray go first.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you, Dale. Thanks. Last thing, get a word in edgeways.
Go on, then.
I think for me, when I was diagnosed, I was actually in full health. I didn't have any symptoms apart from passing blood. I felt I was keeping fit. So I was going to the gym. I felt relatively good. I think my wife noticed that I was partaking in a few afternoon naps, maybe. But then again, living in the Middle East is quite hot. So, you know, nothing better than a good siesta. And even when the doctor told me this, it was just disbelief because I'd never really been to the doctors regularly for ailments in the past. And probably the fact that they said there was nothing they could do for me was probably the main instigator in me making a decision to I had no option but to go down the holistic route, you know. And I thought, well, this oncologist, this guy doesn't know me. He doesn't know what I'm capable of. So it's almost a way of going and proving them wrong, you know. And then obviously with my friend planting the seed of hope as well, it helped me as well. So that's my point of view on it.
A bit of fighting spirit. But yeah, and then importantly, though, that inspiration from somebody else who'd been there, that's quite a big part of it, it sounds like.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. And Dale?
So I think mine's a little bit different to everyone else's. I think I'd actually been to the doctor 20-odd times over the last couple of years before I got diagnosed. I had a mother who, very ironically, was a palliative care nurse for her entire career. So I grew up with, you know, my mum had Bristol stool charts on the bathroom wall in every bathroom and chlamydia tests on the side from, you know, when I was about 7 or 8 years old. She was just that sort of a mum. So to me, I went to the doctor lots. I didn't isolate myself away. My issue was that they didn't believe me. I got as far as being sent for a blood test. I basically got a pat on the head and told, you know, here's some protein pump inhibitors, some omeprazole, you know, lowers your stomach acid. It's obviously you're drinking too much or you're not eating properly or you're not this and you're not this. And I mean, I'm a 6'3" former rugby player. I was fit. I was healthy. I was all these things. Yes, I did smoke at certain points in my life. I did drink at certain points in my life. Yeah, occasionally, maybe not the healthiest of lifestyles, living in central London, etc., as a banker. But that wasn't the underlying life I was living. Underlying that, I was a vegetarian. I would hit the gym all the time. I lived in an apartment block with a gym and a pool. I was healthy. I was, you know, I lived a decent lifestyle. But they just wouldn't see past it. And they wouldn't give me the credit for my symptoms. It was just, it's fine. You're too young for it to be anything interesting. Oh, it's fine. It's obviously your lifestyle. Oh, you work in finance. Oh, it's obviously the networking. You know, you're doing too much networking. All of these sorts of things. So I think my experience is the opposite way around. Right. And when it then came to the actual diagnosis, as weirdly perverse as this sounds, I think it was actually my mother's death that gave me the permission to do what I did.
Right.
Had my mother been alive, because she was such a staunch, you know, NHS person for her entire life. She was a senior palliative care nurse. She worked at the district nurses down in Somerset, pretty much not long until before she died. Had she still been alive, I think she would have told me to do what the doctor said. Uh-huh. She would have, you know, sat there and held my hand through it with the oncologist. But her death, I think, came with a lot of grief and a lot of anger. And because she had been so NHS and because I felt that they had failed her in some way, shape or form, she had a long-term chronic illness with an autoimmune disease. And I felt they'd failed her at certain points. And I think I essentially had the permission to take that out on the oncologist, out on the system itself, because of her death. Mm. So yeah, very different answer to the rest of the guys.
Yeah.
Very different sort of focus for me. Mm-hmm. And then sort of the reason I did it was because having lived through my mother dying, I had two little boys at home at that point. You know, I did my endoscopy on my youngest son's first birthday. When I say little boys, they were little boys. And having felt the pain of losing a parent, I didn't want them to feel the same. So for me, I never set out to cure myself. I never set out to beat cancer. I set out to find ways to make the standard of care more efficacious, to give me as long as possible with them. I didn't set out to go alternative. I didn't think I was going off the beaten track sort of thing. I was just looking at ways to help me survive longer and better, especially having been told that the chemotherapy, you know, as these guys were saying earlier, they didn't want palliative chemotherapy. Well, I took palliative chemotherapy. I wasn't offered anything else. It was kind of a, you know, we have palliative chemotherapy for you. It is going to put you in bed. You are going to be bedbound. Your skin is probably going to peel off. You're going to feel horrendous, and you're probably not going to get to play with your little boys, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So for me, it was about, if I've only got 12 months left, I need to not be that frail, dying cancer patient you see on television. You know, the gray headscarf, unable to get out of bed, frail, broken human being. I didn't want my little boys to remember their daddy that way. I didn't want them to have to see their daddy that way. And I wanted to make memories with them while I still had the time to. So I pushed and forced and kept driving forward because of them. So slightly different focus.
Different focus, but yeah, really interesting. Very strong purpose in it, though.
Concerning a common theme, I was misdiagnosed probably about 2 years beforehand as well. And being the eternal optimist that I am, I was happy with the misdiagnosis and sort of hung on to it too long.
Right.
So if people are listening and they ever do doubt their doctors, sort of, the rhetoric on an illness, I would be going back to ask questions over and over again, particularly when you can see what happened with Dale. That really important to trust your gut instinct,
right,
and go and ask the questions.
Yeah, gut instinct, very important. Guess what, guys, we got through the time already. Amazing. We already feel like we're just getting going, but look, just want to sum up by saying we're going to focus in a lot more on your shared experiences. To spend more time teasing out the commonalities, the important bits, wanting to share those with other men. The ultimate aim is to have you four at our conference on the 26th of September in central London. I want to encourage any men who are listening, or even the wives of men who are listening to this show, to get along to this conference. We want to see many more men than usual at this conference. There'll be an hour's opportunity to listen to you four men, to question you, to get to grips with all the things that have allowed you, enabled you to turn around a seemingly hopeless situation and turn it into something quite different. So it's extraordinary stories you've all got. They're well worth sharing, and I want to get them out there as widely as possible. So this is a little starting point. I think we've got off to a great start, but there's plenty more. So I want to thank you all very much indeed for joining me today.
Likewise, Robin, and thank you, fellas. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, cool, man.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being head, Murray.
Cheers, guys.
Bye.
Yeah. It's all right. Take care, guys. Bye now.
Speak to you, guys.
As I mentioned, you'll be hearing more from our four men in the coming weeks. And the campaign will culminate in their taking to the stage at our autumn conference, Reclaiming Our True Nature, which is taking place on the 26th of September in central London. The floor will be open for question and answer, and we sincerely hope many more men than usual will come along to take advantage of the opportunity to meet and question these four amazing survivors to find out more about what they have found out. The four men will also feature in our Yes to Life Global Camino Challenge in October that aims to raise £100,000 to support people with cancer in exploring integrative options. Find out more about that at thecaminochallenge.yestolife.org.uk. And you'll also be hearing more about the Yes to Life Chart for Oncology that sets out our views on the changes needed in oncology in order to support a move to a more holistic, loving way of delivering cancer care. Find out more about that by clicking the large orange button immediately below the headline banner of the homepage at yestolife.org.
www.theshowmakesyoufeelgood.org.uk. Hope you enjoyed this first meetup with our four men. I'll be back again next week with another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio, so I hope you listen again. Goodbye.